Good evening. Well, I thought I'd carry on slightly from where I left off last time I spoke to you. We were talking about the mountains of faith at the end of summer. And so I wanted to go back to Mount Carmel because I was taken very much by this account on Mount Carmel of Elijah and his prophecy. And despite us being talking about the mountains again, the title for this evening's address is Sitting on the Fence, because that's what God's people were doing. Another title I thought we could have looked at was A Kingdom Divided. So Mount Carmel is in a very fertile and strategic valley, the Jezreel Valley. The Mount Carmel literally means God's vineyard. The mountain range runs southeast to northwest for about 30 miles in the western part of the Jezreel Valley. And this part of Israel receives about 30 inches of rain a year, which is about one day in Cornwall at the moment, I think. And it's the most heavily forested area of the country. And if you look at the valley from the mountaintop, this is a view from the top of Mount Carmel here, you can see that it's an extremely fertile and valuable resource for the people there in terms of food production. It's a very beautiful area, and it's frequently mentioned in the Bible that it's very beautiful and fruitful. And as such, it became a symbol to God's people for its blessing, the Lord's blessing on their land, because of the fertility and the fruitfulness of it. And if we look at Mount Carmel today, we find, as much as it was back in God's people's time, that it's covered in olive trees. From the time of Jesus, we can understand why this place has become to symbolise so much about the fertility and blessing of God's people. The olive tree is one of the plants that's mentioned in the Bible, and the Old Testament in particular notes that it is a tree of beauty. In Jeremiah and Hosea, they both mention that the olive tree in its fruitfulness is a symbol of God's blessing. And faithful followers to God are compared to vigorous olive trees, and their children are said to be like the shoots that appear on the trees, guaranteeing the tree's survival. And scripture writers use the olive tree imagery to describe Jesus' Jewish roots and his relationship to the Jews and also the Gentiles. When an olive tree is very old, as we can see up, on the left-hand side here, what the farmers do is they cut the top of the tree off and they leave just a stump and they allow the shoots to grow again because it's become so old, it hasn't become so fruitful. So by taking the top of the tree off and encouraging new growth, then they can improve their harvest. Very soon after cutting the stump, new shoots grow and the tree begins to produce olives again. And this aspect of the olive tree provides an image of Isaiah's prophecy: a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit, Isaiah tells us in chapter 11. As a descendant of David, Jesus was the shoot of the stump of Jesse, David's father. The New Testament uses olive trees as well to help illustrate God's plan of salvation. In Romans, Paul describes in at length, actually, in chapter 11, that Christians are either natural olive branches, those of Jewish background, or olive branches that have been grafted onto Jesus. And you can see on the right-hand side there, a grafting. You have to do lots of this in biology at school. We do improving the stock of the plants. And that by grafting the trees in this way and by pruning the tree in this way, almost sacrificing the top of the tree, as God very did much with his own son, that we can bring fruit back to the tree. And as branches are grafted into Jesus, Christians will bear fruit as we attach to him and have a personal relationship with him. So the olive tree that covers the slopes of Mount Carmel provides an excellent lesson for Christians, both those who are Jewish and those who are not. Though God cut many of the Jewish branches down because they rejected Jesus as Messiah, he did not uproot the tree, the shoot of Jesus and the branches of his Gentile followers grew from a Jewish stump. And as Christians, we are branches growing from our Jewish roots. The olive tree then can be a constant reminder that Jesus is the source of our life, our branch springing from Jewish roots. And the beautiful olive tree reminds us of God's amazing plan of salvation and his expectation that all his branches will bear fruit in abundance. Cutting through the Jezreel Valley is a road called the Via Maris, which literally means the sea way, or the way of the sea. Because of its fertility, the surrounding land was the breadbasket of Israel, and Mount Carmel stood at a very high point, very high strategic point, along this road, this Roman road. The Via Maris enters the Great Rift Valley from the east and continues south to the Sea of Galilee, and it then turns southwest into the Valley of Jezreel and cuts through the ridge of Mount Carmel to reach the coastal plain. And after arriving at the plain there, the road continues along the coast towards Egypt. So it's a very, very important route to travel for traders. And it's been equated to something like the spice routes, which would traditionally come across from Asia, across the Indian routes, and then into Europe. So it's a vital route. And the rugged mountain ranges that cut through the middle of Israel made it incredibly difficult to travel other than along this route. And civilizations such as the Egyptians and Babylonians and the Assyrians depended on trade to exchange and acquire necessary goods along this route. So whoever controlled this route between these empires dominated the international trade and had tremendous influence on other cultures. That was the importance. If you controlled the road, you had influence. There are three cities that you can see along the route there. And these were very especially important because of their significant guarding role across the road. Hazor guarded a narrow section at the Rift Valley. Giza stood where the road jogged inland to avoid some swampy areas. And it also connected the Via Maris to the east-west road that led to Jericho. And Megiddo, which is the site of the famous Battle of Armageddon, the most important city in the ancient world at that time, guarded the crucial mountain pass through Mount Carmel. However, despite the significance of this road and these mountains, the Israelites were losing out or lost out. They were really afraid of the Philistines and the Canaanites. The Israelites stayed mainly in the mountains and the foothills of the Shephelah, which are on the coastal side of this mountain range. They rarely controlled these key cities along this route, nor the mount itself. And as such, they could exert very little influence upon the world that God had intended them to have by having this land. This road saw ordinary travellers and merchants and diplomats and caravans, as well as armies and a few more of our recognisable biblical characters. Joseph, when he was sold by his brothers to Ishmaelite traders, was on the Via Maris. They were going off to Egypt. Later, the route was controlled by the Philistines, and it took a boy called David to teach a lesson to Goliath to get control back for a short period of this route. And that was one of the reasons that David became a great king, because he controlled the route and therefore had great wealth, and also his son, Solomon. But there was confusion when the Israelites were in this area. They were very confused about God. Whilst the area was a place of great blessing for them and symbolised God's blessing through its fertility, it also symbolised God's judgment on the land. And on several occasions, God allowed Mount Carmel and the surrounding lands to become withered and desolate as a result of the Israelites' disobedience. One of these droughts ended with the famous confrontation we've just heard about between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. As they left the wilderness and settled in these fertile lands, the Israelites started to wonder if God was only the God of the wilderness, the God for the hard times, the God for when it was a bit difficult, when you were having trouble. And actually, for the good times, there were other gods. So although God had demonstrated his power time after time, the Israelites started to embrace the other gods, and many of them joined fertility cults, mistakenly believing that the pagan god Baal would provide the rain they needed for healthy crops. So Baal, who we can see here, was the Canaanite god of storm and rain. In addition, Asherah was frequently mentioned at this time, and they used to put up Asherah poles, which, believe it or not, are coming back into fashion. I was almost shocked to hear about this level of idolatry. Out in the States in particular, you find them in nightclubs, and out and about in California, they put them around the farms because they believe they will bless the land. These are trees, sacred trees or sacred poles that they've dressed up. And Asherah is believed to be, actually, the blasphemy of it is incredible. They believed her to be God's consort, and that she was the mother of earth, the queen of heaven. So there was lots of mixing between the true religion and between Jehovah in the Israelites' minds and a lot of these pagan rituals. And around 850 BC, King Ahab became the king of Israel and the northern tribes. And as we could have read earlier in 1 Kings, we read that it says that Ahab did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He married Jezebel, a Phoenician woman who practiced an extreme form of this Baal worship. And he built Baal altars and Asherah poles in Israel's capital city of that time, Samaria. But Ahab hadn't completely abandoned his Jewish faith or roots. And this is where his confusion, this is where he was wavering, where he was sitting on the fence. He named his children with Jewish names and forms of the Yahweh in Hebrew. So like many of the Israelites of his day, he seemed to believe that both Baal and Yahweh, Jehovah, were true gods. We then heard extensively there in the passage in 1 Kings about how God then called his first prophet Elijah. Elijah told the king Ahab that God would demonstrate his power by bringing a drought upon the land, something that Baal was supposed to be able to control. Elijah warned Ahab, God is in control. God was displeased when his people had blended Baal worship with the worship of him, and Baal's followers perverted the truth, and God wanted his people to recognize them as frauds. So he sent prophets out to warn them, to point out the empty promises of Baal, and to warn of the consequences if they continue to hope in false gods. And Elijah was the first of these. And Elijah's name means Yahweh is God. Elijah told Ahab there would be no rain or dew in Israel for years. And this message cut to the heart of all those who believed in Baal and Asherah, the supposed god of rain and fertility. And Elijah's message claimed that God was not just a god of wilderness, but he was God over all. The ensuing drought created a dilemma for the Baal worshippers. Who was really the god of the land, Baal or Jehovah? 3.5 years later, Elijah answered that very question, and he came onto the scene to confront the prophets of Baal and Asherah. At the beginning of his meeting with those prophets, Elijah challenged the Israelites, saying, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." In other words, stop sitting on the fence. It's time to choose. Elijah knew the Israelites had not completely abandoned God, but they were certainly not giving him their total allegiance. And Elijah's challenge echoed the words of Joshua that he'd used earlier to call the Israelites to complete loyalty. And we read that Joshua said, "If the serving of the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." In Joshua's day, the people had enthusiastically responded, claiming faith in God alone. But Elijah's challenge, if you notice when we read it there, was met with silence. the people said nothing. And just thinking a bit what you were praying about earlier, Gaius, concerning these antisocial orders, I think how important it is for us to stand up. How often it's not easy, but we need to stand up for Jesus. And how often is it very easy just to say nothing when we need to say something? So God's people were confused. Elijah then asked God to demonstrate his power over Baal so that the people would know he alone was God. He prepared an offering, challenged Baal's followers to see whose God produced the fire to burn it. And as we read, after hours of frantic efforts, Baal had still not responded to the cries of his followers, which of course he wouldn't, because he's a bit of bronze or a bit of clay, more frail than we are. So Elijah stepped to the altar and, after dousing it with water, prayed to God, and in response, God sent down such a consuming fire that the sacrifice, the altar, and the water were completely burned up. The people's silence was broken. They chanted, "Elijah, Elijah." In other words, as we said earlier, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is God. The Lord is God. The Baal prophets were then put to death, and Elijah prayed again, asking for rain. Empowered with the Spirit, he ran to Jezreel. That's 19 miles away, by the way, from where the mountain is. So it's not a short distance to be going, but it shows you what you can do when you're running on the Spirit. And he got there even faster than King Ahab's chariots could reach it. The drought had ended because the one true God had sent rain to the land. Today, we still face the same culture of false gods. We must challenge each other to follow God with complete loyalty. And today there are many people who are still confused about God. The world around us offers us various attractions: health, wealth, entertainment, romantic love, promises of happiness and prosperity, especially at this time of New Year. Okay, how many people have wished you a happy New Year and a prosperous New Year? What is that prosperity really going to be measured in? In and of themselves, none of these things are evil, of course. But they become problematic when people start to treat them like gods. These false gods easily creep into our own lives. And I thought about this over the holiday period. Okay, we visit the shopping centres. I was watching the news. The one good thing about being up in Scotland there for the holiday was we were trapped most of the time in the village. So apart from the local store, you can hardly get to the sales. But we were seeing plenty of it on the television. And I'm sure we would have been just like everyone else going to the sales if we'd been down here. Okay, these are the modern day temples, aren't they? These huge shopping malls and shopping centres. Vast, vast expanses. Bigger than any cathedral. And they serve the gods of materialism. Even their structure internally, you know, gives you that cathedral-like feeling. You look up into the vaulted ceilings. And of course, they're packed with their worshippers. Traveling back down from Scotland, we travelled on the Sunday, and we had to call in to get some like picnic supplies on the way down, and we couldn't believe how busy the towns were, packed full of people. And all looking to become blessed in their consumption and find self-esteem in the things that they buy and we buy. We're looking for security and joy, love for or within the money or what money could buy us, instead of looking first to God. And looking at the Israelites, we can easily recognize how mistaken they were to blend the worship of Baal and the worship and faith in God. But I think as we look to our own lives, the task becomes a lot more difficult. The lines are blurred, and the promises of these false gods are very, very convincing at times. As we stand amidst these competing ideas of our world, Christians must remember the lessons of Mount Carmel. God alone is the Lord of our lives. Like Elijah, we should challenge our culture and each other to follow God with this complete loyalty. How long will we waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, we must follow him. But if it's money or romance or material success, then follow those. As we go about our day-to-day activities, will people see that the one true God, or will they see the gods of our culture? Elijah understood his calling very well. His name, very name, meant Yahweh is God, the Lord is God, and his life displayed it in a very powerful way because he developed a constant relationship with God. He was empowered to perform the amazing miracle on Mount Carmel. In a world where people waver between these false gods, Christians should stand out because of their total commitment to God. Like Elijah, we are empowered by the Spirit. And if we live out our calling, we can show our world the one true God. And we can successfully expose the false promises of other gods. In a sense, we can all become Elijahs. The people whose very existence points to the one true God. There are lots of people asking this question. Who is God? As people observe us at home, at work, at school, at play, will they know the answer to this question, who is God? Now, I hope this bit works. It does, good. Will we be able to do this? Will we be able to show him, them, God who is? Not who is God, but the God who is. So as we go about our day-to-day activities, what will they see? The God of self, the God of materialism, or the one true God? And just as the Israelites rarely controlled those key cities along the Via Maris, so they could not exert the degree of influence upon the world that God wished for them to have, so we can miss out on having an influence in our society today if we shy away from broadcasting to those around us who God is. Not just with our words, but probably I would say more importantly, our conduct, our action, and our deeds also. So once again, a mountain site has become a focal point in the Bible and in world history. It served as a place where God of heaven validated his faithful servant Elijah and contacted his people, for whom he cared greatly, despite their abandonment of him. Notice that they talked about the altar was ruined. The altar was ruined, and Elijah rebuilt the altar, much as God, through Christ, does with his church today. Israel was to learn that a merciful and gracious God is ever able to help his people who call on him in full sincerity and genuine faith. In 2 Peter we read, "The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance." It was a fitting lesson for God's people under the old covenant, and remains so for those who are heirs, as we are, grafted into Jesus, okay, of the new covenant. The contest on Mount Carmel reminds today's believer that nothing should displace the Lord as the centre of his or her life. Whether in the worship experience or in everyday pursuits of life. Dear children, John writes, keep yourselves from idols. Mount Carmel testifies to God's mercy and goodness and his concern for his people via his correction and care. And this challenges us as believers to let God's goodness flow out through us. Again, we read in John 3, chapter 11, John writes, "Dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God, and anyone who does what is evil has not seen God." Elijah's calling on God and the Lord's answer should serve as a stimulus to prayer. And that is a very powerful tool, as you were referring to earlier, Gaius. While understanding the great potential that we gain from in doing so in accordance with God's will. How long will you waver between in two opinions? There is no sitting on a fence. In fact, this fence is a gate fence. And this reminds me of a very famous speech made at this time of year, a long time ago, in 1939, by King George, which was made very famous in the recent film The King's Speech. I don't know whether you've seen that. King George gave his address to the nation when the nation faced many distractions and great anxiety at the onset of World War II. A poem that had been written by a lady who was a very good Christian woman called Minnie Louise Haskins. She was a Sunday school teacher, a missionary, and latterly an academic professor and tutor at the London School of Economics. And her colleagues described her at the LSE, so the people she worked with and spent her time with, as a woman of unusual capacity and character, one with a rare understanding and sympathy and infinite patience, combined with a great deal of love and interest in people. I would suggest that Minnie Louise Haskins was letting God's goodness flow out through her to those around her. Her poem, which she wrote originally to raise funds to go out to India, was put into a Christmas card and given to the Queen, what was the Queen Mother. And she passed it on to King George. And you may have heard these words before. And he quoted it in his address. And I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, "Give me a light that I may tread safely unto the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than the light and safer than a known way." The following verse, which you didn't quote from, and I think I'd like to finish on tonight, goes, "So I went forth, and finding the hand of God, trod gladly into the night. And where did he lead them? And he led me towards the hills, back to the mountains, and the breaking of day in the lone east." My prayer is that for the coming year, 2014, that we may all see God's blessing, as the Israelites did see it in Israel, in Jezreel Valley, and most importantly, that the blessing that we see flows through us and to those around us and those we come into contact with, and not least that they will see God's healing and that they will also be grafted into the stump of Jesse, which is Christ our Saviour. Amen.